Okay.
Good. This is an oral history interview being done on the 7th of September, 2017, in the Donnelly Room, Galvin Library. We're speaking with George Langlois, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Research and Service at IIT. This interview is being conducted by Adam Strom, Director of University Archives and Special Collections, and myself, Ralph Pugh, University Archivist. So thanks very much for coming on over.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Great.
Good. I'm honored to be asked.
All right. Well, yeah, now we understand that you are quite articulate and have stories to tell and whatnot, so we won't even wait till your retirement. In terms of doing this. So, alert, he's not retiring.
Okay.
All right. Oftentimes we start off by asking people to go back as far as they want to in terms of formative experiences leading that seem to lead you to where you are today, what your education was, and we'll open it up to you.
Okay, well, I can start with how I got to IIT. And before that, I was at St. Anselm College, a small liberal arts college in New Hampshire, famous for the presidential debates happened in New Hampshire, the first in the country. They were on my campus. I decided to go into industrial psychology, and I looked around the country, and IIT had a great program in industrial psychology.
Okay.
And they accepted me, and I accepted them, and came here, and I never turned back. It was a good decision, outstanding decision. I met wonderful people. The week I got here, I met wonderful people. The growth for me was, or the surprise for me, is how mathematical the degree was. My undergrad was much more theoretical and humanistic psychology, but in industrial psychology, Dr. Raju, Namuri Raju, was the head of that program, or was actually the new professor in that program at the time. He became head later, but his degree was in math and psychology, so I had to adapt to a lot of stats and a lot of math, which ironically I turned out to be good at. So I was top of my class in that, which either the class was low or I was high. I won't comment on that.
Okay.
So that's how I got to IIT, and when I got here, I was a bit, I was too economically disadvantaged to come out here. So my parents were not rich. I'm from lower middle class. My father was a factory worker. So I relied on pictures in the catalog. And so I saw the fountain in front of Pearlstein, and I said, that looks like a nice campus. I'm going to go there. So I came from an ivy-covered building campus with rolling hills to here. And I think what Sharon was referring to is when I got here, I wouldn't get out of the taxi. I thought it was an industrial park. I kept going to the taxi driver. No, I want a college. This is an industrial park. And he said, no, you want IIT? It's here. And the students came out of the dorms and opened the door for me and said, are you here for IIT? And I said, yes. They said, well, you're here. Oh, all right. But what I found was incredibly friendly people right away. The warmth of the Midwestern locations was in complete comparison to Boston and the East Coast. I still love the East Coast, but it's a much more state area where people are more cautious about talking to you and want to know why that you're talking to them. Whereas here, everybody seemed to be helping and be looking to make me comfortable.
Oh, all right. So you've graduated to being a Midwesterner.
I've been here 38 years, I'm not turning back now. I still get back there routinely because I consult with my old college also, and I go home obviously once or twice a year.
Oh, okay, good. So you're born and raised in New England?
In Lewiston, Maine.
Okay.
Where Bates College is, and people know that, or Bates Mill, the factories.
And so your arrival here, we're talking late 1970s, correct?
Right, 1979.
Okay, and so the campus construction, you know, in that lull.
Right.
So the campus generally looks as it was going to look for a few decades.
It did not overwhelm you with its beauty, I'll put it that way. There were no paved parking lots. They were all mostly gravel. And there were no fencing. The brick fencing you see now with the wrought iron grills, that was not here. Those were open gravel pits. Morton Park was a gravel pit where people parked there, but it was all gravel again. And there were no trees of note on campus. That's why it looked so industrial. It was very stark. And I was used to lush green and ivy everywhere. And I thought, this is a little bit scary. But the warmth of the professors and the students made you feel at home. And ironically, I got a call from University of Nebraska giving me a scholarship 2 weeks after I got here, and I turned it down to stay here. I didn't even look at Nebraska because I fell in love with IIT.
At the campus safety at that time, we, in terms of the parking lots, I know in the late 1960s, from research we've done, students were complaining about the lack of security in the parking lots. Had that been rectified 10 years later by the time that you came, or was it still pretty dicey in terms of that? Did you commute?
I lived on campus. I lived in okay. Graduate Hall.
Okay.
And I didn't, I don't know what it was like before, but it was a bit threatening for me. The first night I was here, I was in the dormitories, and a group of students noticed I was from out of town and said, hey, come with us, we'll get some beer, and we'll have a little gathering in our rooms, and took me across 35th Street, which back in 1979 was the demarcation line. You didn't cross the street. And so they took me in, and I noticed that there was a turnstile with heavy glass, and I'd never seen anything like that. I said, why are they talking to me through a microphone? And then I have to put my money in. They turn it, they put the beer in. They said, oh, it's because it's a not secure area. It's very dangerous. And a student from IIT got shot in the head last week. And I said, why did you take me here? It's the only place to get beer.
You weren't sure about the risk.
No, I was not. If I had been aware of the risk, I would not have taken the risk.
Right. Yeah.
So I was not happy with them at that moment. But from then on, I started going to the pub, which was, it was called the Bog. It still is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was fun. But it was safer than going across 35th Street just to get a six pack of beer.
Yeah.
So I was a little shocked at the security. And we got a security briefing when I first got here, in terms of you have to cooperate with your attackers to not be hurt. And right. So if you get approached by people, just give them the money and don't argue.
Okay. This is before campus phones and buzzers and
absolutely
all those
before
sorts of things,
yeah. So this is the ancient days. So, right. So there weren't a lot of electronics at all.
Yeah.
And so campus security was present and helpful, but they couldn't be everywhere. And so every now and again you'd hear about something going on campus that was unsavory. And at one point, we even had somebody follow a female gang follow us into life sciences and hid out in a room. And we knew they were hiding because they did it in front of us. They weren't terribly creative. But so a group of graduate students had to chase them out of the building. Those were much rougher days. And so I noticed. I don't want to imply that it's anything like that now because it's changed dramatically. And so when I came back to be on staff, I was shocked at the beauty of the campus, how many trees were up, the new buildings and all of that. But back in 79, it was not a physically welcoming campus.
Right. Was that a student who was shot, did he or she die? Or
I have no idea.
Okay.
But it was shocking to me. Again, I had arrived that night and welcome, but stay here, don't cross the street. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
And
but despite that, you turned down an offer from Nebraska 2 weeks later, and
well,
you were here for 10 years.
Right, yes, that's true, because I had met Dr. Raju and the students, and they created a family atmosphere in that department, in the industrial psychology department. I was in the greatest psychology department, but industrial psychology students really bonded quickly, and they had cookouts, and we get to know each other, and the faculty were very accessible. And it's a long story, but Dr. Raju became like my father away from home, and he did that with a number of students. And so when he passed many years later, so I guess maybe 10 years ago now, or from here, or 13 years, we all came for his services. And every one of us started his eulogy, well, I was his favorite student. And we were all shocked.
We all felt that way.
As the next person got up, we're like, no, I was. And, but he and his wife had adopted a bunch of people from out of town, and we were there for the holidays and for weddings for their children. So
yeah, you couldn't travel back home very often, I'm sure.
Yes. So I stayed on campus, and I went home once a year.
Okay.
And it was going to be either Christmas or another one, but it couldn't be two because I couldn't afford it.
Did your family or folks ever get here during your time in school?
My sister came my first year to visit, and she enjoyed herself here. She loves Chicago. My parents didn't make it until I graduated. They were in Chicago. I had moved off campus when they first came, but when I graduated, they came to the campus, and they came at night for the. I graduated in December, and they there was a nighttime graduation at that point. In the Herman Hall, massive auditorium, and they got here, so they didn't quite see the campus. So it was a kind of a blessing because that might have scared them.
And so when you got here. In 79, was the plan to go straight through and get your PhD?
It was to go straight through and get my PhD, but as I pursued my PhD, I got a job. I got an internship with IBM because Dr. Raju had worked there and had been head of research. And so he could place a student there every year, which is one of the hallmarks of that department, that we get internships, and we all get jobs faster than we should. And so I got an internship, and then I got recruited to Montgomery Ward as head of management development before I got my master's. And I'm not an outlier. That happened to a lot of students. And so what happened is I just, in addition to discovering IIT, you move off campus if you're working downtown, and you get to go to the city, and you fall in love with the city and IIT. And so it just became this snowballing thing. I went from Montgomery Ward. They shut down our department early on. They were struggling. And then I went to work for JCPenney's, and a new startup. And within a year and a half, that failed. None of this is my fault, by the way. So we're clear.
For the record.
Yeah. But at Montgomery, at JCPenney's, it was a small startup, it was a high-tech startup. They put me on the management committee early on, so I get to see the decision-making. And I thought, geez, I can do this. And so when I left there, one of my colleagues from Montgomery Ward had started a company and said, would you come to work for me? And he said, you can be president of your own division and you can start that up. So I took that route and built a company that had about 40 people across the country. We had four offices at the height, Atlanta, San Francisco, Boston, and Chicago. Very profitable, and really enjoyed that work. And it's all because of IIT. I wouldn't be there if it had not been for IIT. They teach you, even then we weren't focusing on entrepreneurship, but we're all entrepreneurs here. We're all inventing things or figuring out how to get a better situation than was before.
So it sounds like you made a pretty good decision even entering in 1979, already having focused on industrial psychology. How did you get to that point?
Well, in undergraduate, I had taken an internship in my senior year, because at St. Anselm, we all had to take an internship, and we all had to do a final project for senior year. A capstone, if you will. And I was working in a group home with children who were displaced because the parents were bad. They had not done anything bad. Their parents were abusing them or doing selling drugs or whatever it was, and we had them in the house to take care of. And I found I was taking my work home with me. And I was getting depressed and angry. And I went to my advisor and I said, this clinical psychology is not cut out for me. And originally I had thought I was going to be a priest. St. Anselm trains a lot of priests for the Diocese of Maine. And I thought I might be that. And when that wasn't working out, I said, I need something else. And he's the one who said, I had worked for him for 3 years. I was his assistant in the office. And he said, I've noticed you're quite structured and you're business process oriented. And he said, have you thought about industrial psychology? And I've never heard of it. So in my senior year, or maybe it was junior year, I took one course in it, and that's all you offered at undergraduate anyway, and fell in love with it. This makes a lot of sense. I can apply what I learned to work, and I don't have to worry about kids being abused, people jumping out a window. I can sleep at night. And so...
Very important.
Yeah. And when I looked up programs, IIT had one of the stronger programs. And I was, ironically, accepted also to Penn State.
Comparable strength in terms of institutions?
I'd say they were stronger, but here's the... I was a little arrogant, because I was top of my class at St. Anselm, and I thought, I'm a big deal. And so I had checked off I want a PhD, and Penn State at the time wasn't accepting PhDs from undergrad. They would say, you can come and get your master's, and if you qualify, you'd get your PhD. Mm-hmm. So they called me and said, did you mean to mark PhD or master's? And I said, I want PhD. So, well, you're not going to get a PhD with an undergraduate. And I was cocky enough, and I just said, well, that's what I want. And they said, okay, and I get my rejection letter almost immediately. IIT, on the other hand, said, we'll accept you for a PhD, but you're going to have to prove yourself in your master's, sure. but you're in the PhD program. Yeah. So kind of reverse engineering, if you will, you know, saying if you don't make it, we're not giving it to you, but you're in it now.
Yeah, and so I had to go through that hurdle.
So I went to that hurdle, and so that's how I got here.
Okay.
And I hadn't applied to a lot of schools. It was just Penn State here, I think Rutgers, and Rutgers was not appealing to me in New Jersey. I want to get away from New England a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
And University of Nebraska had a good program also.
Okay.
But I would imagine the chance to kind of get into the workforce immediately, State College, Pennsylvania, is not going to offer the opportunities that Chicago would.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of opportunity here. And as I networked with people, they were very clear about you're going to have more opportunities in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And my relatives who had traveled, I also had applied to Wayne State up in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an idea how backwards our country my parents were and my family were, they said, oh, Detroit's a lot better city. You should look at that one. And my godmother, who had done a bit of traveling, said, no, Chicago's the best city. It's safer, it's clean, it's nice, and so she held sway with me.
Uh-huh.
And when I got here, ironically, one of my colleagues is from Detroit, and so I applied to Wayne State, and my family was lobbying for Wayne State, and he said, you made the right decision, I wouldn't go to Detroit right now. Detroit at the time was apparently very dangerous, and he said, you're better off here.
Yeah.
So.
Right, yeah, glory. Detroit had its glory days in the 20s and whatnot, but 40s and precipitous decline in the 60s.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Well, witness where they are now. They're not anywhere near where Chicago is economically.
Yeah.
So this was the right decision to make. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that I could study with real scholars that were solid, but then I also had people that would hire me very quickly and I could learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed starting a business was easy here.
Yeah.
And I can tell you when I had my business and I tried to open an office in Boston, we did, but that office got business in San Francisco because Bostonians want to hire people who are from Boston. And San Francisco was a pretty open city as well. Atlanta wanted people from the South. So I learned all that by being in Chicago and starting businesses, because I've had three businesses, but the major one was Organizational Effectiveness Consultants.
Okay, well, Chicago lived up to its reputation of being a real hub for all sorts of connections that could be made. So, and yeah, Montgomery Ward, what a classic Chicago place. Yeah.
It was, and I got there at the wrong time. They were in decline. I have a knack for that. But they were struggling, and I was in charge of employee surveys. And so that was exciting because I could travel the country and help different stores and organizations get better with employee surveys and do action planning. And then we would turn around situations where they were going after a union, they wanted to have a union. And as I intervened, it's like, well, we don't need a union if you'll do that. And I wasn't trying to union the bus because my dad was a union boss. So that was not my mindset. But my dad was curious. He kept saying, well, what's wrong with the union being in there? I said, well, nothing. I went in to fix problems. I didn't know the union was knocking at the door that strongly.
And so so you do that for, I guess, almost 7 years here at Organizational Effectiveness Consultants.
Right.
And then Organizational Strategies Incorporated.
Well, what happened is that company grew. We had grown to be about a $4.5 million group. Of a $6 million company. So we're the lion's share. And the philosophies of the senior management were changing. And so we were partners. There were three of us that were part of my company. Myself, Dan Lazat, who's also an alumnus of here.
Okay.
You may want to talk to him at some point as well.
Okay.
And Diane Salomon, who was my sister. We were running the three main offices, and we had a difference of opinion with the two owners, but they had given us stock. So we own part of the company.
Oh, okay.
So we just said, we're not agreeing on how we're going forward. We should part company.
Okay.
And they agreed with us. They weren't happy with us doing it, but they had no choice, really. But
okay.
We were leaving. And all of us were single and had worked like dogs to get the company up and going and made it a success of it. And we said, well, we don't have our own personal lives. So when we went to organizational strategies, we reformed it into something that was much more localized, because the other business was across the country and international as well.
Yeah.
So the next company was much more focused in Chicago and or Boston, and that made it easier for us to keep a personal life. And as a result, the three of us are married, and very happy. So
good.
That turned out well, but our customers ironically followed us.
Oh, good, good.
And so the old owner was disappointed. He said, how come they're all following you? And I said, well, they worked directly with us, and you didn't follow up with them at all when we left.
Mm-hmm.
You expected them to call you,
mm-hmm.
and that's not how that works. And
okay.
So.
Yeah. When did you finalize the PhD? Was it the the break between the two? Or
it was during organizational effectiveness consultants. And it was partway through that, almost towards the end of that.
Okay.
And I had toyed with not finishing my PhD. And I had met with my colleagues, and I said, I don't think I'm going to finish my doctorate. Because I'm already doing well. I'm making lots of money. I'm not sure what I'm going to get with a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as psychologists tend to do, they go, well, that's okay. I'm all right. You're all right. You know, it's everybody's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I met with Dr. Raju as a final one.
Still around.
And he was always an even-keeled, mild-mannered person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time I ever heard him curse.
Mm.
And he said, no effing way. You're leaving. He said, you have to get your doctorate. You've been here a long time. You're a good student. You're a PhD. There's no way around that. You're finishing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I really fought him because I'd had health concerns. Because early on in my life, I had heart attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I had my first heart attack at 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, I don't know if I want to put myself through this. And ironically, I got through it.
Mm-hmm.
Not ironically, I shouldn't say ironically, but I did get through it. And I'd look back now and say that's the best decision I made, because Dr. Raju's opinion was, if you do this now and you don't finish, you're going to kick yourself when you're 50 years old, because if you've got your doctorate, all you have to do is your dissertation at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this. Get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Just buckle down. I don't think he realized how hard it was to run a huge company, or at least in my mind, it was a huge company.
Yeah.
But we got that done, and I don't regret it at all.
So the partners just carried a bit more of the load for a while? Or
not really.
I just had to keep juggling
and making it work.
Okay.
And then I got the doctorate, and then a few years later I had bypass surgery at 35.
Okay.
And so that also contributed to my leaving the company and saying, you know what, I'm not getting any younger. I really want to have a life.
Yeah.
And the others were also tired and exhausted because we had two philosophies. Our philosophy was, if you build a company with our employees and everybody shares in the wealth, it'll grow.
Mm.
So we incented everybody with bonuses through secretaries and clerks. Everybody got a bonus at the holidays. If we did well, everybody got something. If we didn't, no one got anything.
Okay.
So now it was not evenly distributed, because if you sold the account, you got more money.
Right.
But when we gave secretaries and clerks a $1,500 bonus at Christmas, they were very happy.
Sure.
So it worked really well.
Good.
His philosophy was juxtaposed. His was, you pay them as least as you can, you maximize your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we left, he struggled. And the people that, my staff that was left there, pretty much left immediately.
I imagine.
Because he changed everything around.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, there's no point in staying anymore. But I'm proud of the way we built that company.
Yeah.
And I still, through that, I had a lot of interns from IIT and the other schools in Chicago and in all those cities. And you build a network of people that throughout the country who I'm very proud of to this day. Some of my proteges are VPs of major corporations at this point.
That's a legacy.
That's a legacy, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. I'm glad you can do that for yourself and for
for folks. That's something that hopefully they'll say about you at some point.
Well, I hope so. I'm still in touch with most of them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
But I'm heartened by the whole thing, because I thought, well, when you're working with young professionals and you're hard on them or you're pushing them, mm-hmm. you're never sure how they're taking it. And they're not really taking it well. They're saying, well, you're pushing too hard, or what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
But when a couple of them have left, the IIT students in particular, I know, one came back and she was just angry with me. She said, he pushed me so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And later she told Dr. Iman, who's still here in the IO psychology department, she told her, so I learned my craft through George. He mm-hmm. was the one who pushed me to learn.
Okay. Mm-hmm. She came around to that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So the wisdom of years in the business.
Yeah, right.
And it sounds like the kind of warm family atmosphere that you found when you got here
mm-hmm.
maybe inspired kind of the way that you worked with younger folks and students throughout your life.
Right. My philosophy was, we're going to be a collegial company.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to be competing internally.
Mm-hmm.
We're competing externally.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to work as a team, and an interdisciplinary team. That was something also that I insisted on. Because my peers who had started their own companies in industrial psychology
mm-hmm.
had all industrial psychologists working for them. That's all they hired.
Okay.
And the first time I hired somebody who was not, I got questions about, well, why would you hire an MBA to work for you?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, because they bring a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Or why did you hire that PhD in communications? I said,
mm-hmm.
again, they bring a different view to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought was, if we have all these views at the table, we can bring a better solution to every client.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not just looking at through a mini microscope kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're looking at the broad picture. And our clients felt the same way. And because of that, we weren't seen as doctor. We were seen
mm-hmm.
as partners. And so one of our big clients, one of the transformational clients we had at OEC, was the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know we could get that account. We didn't know what we didn't know. So
yeah, yeah.
we went and bid on it. And they liked our proposal because we were very methodological. Yes, yes. Very structured.
Methodical, sorry.
Methodical. Methodical is the word, yes.
Yeah.
The methodology was clearly outlined, who would do what, when, or what, you know, and how
mm-hmm.
much it would cost for each piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started getting called back. Can you come and talk to us more about that proposal?
Uh-huh.
I thought, my God. And we had never had a big account. We had maybe a $20,000 a year account.
Uh-huh.
This was going to be about $500,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, they're calling us back. That's strange. Okay, so we'll go back and forth with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was going on vacation up to Montreal, and they called and said, you're a finalist. We need you that week.
Uh-huh.
I said, oh my God. I said, that's my vacation week. can I possibly come in on that following Monday? They said, no. They said, that's fine. We'll call you next time. We'll do a survey, but we want... you have to be here that week. And I said, can I be there Friday? And I said, yeah, sure, you can be the last one in. And so we went in,
mm-hmm.
and Dan Lozat was the partner with me, and they liked us. And so as we walked out, our contact gave us a thumbs up saying, you're the guys they're picking.
Wow, and so you didn't even have to sweat it.
I couldn't, well, we didn't want to put on, we were very quiet as we left, like, thank you very much, thank you. And then
mm-hmm.
we danced in the elevator. And we didn't know we were being watched in the elevator because they told us, we saw you dance. I'm like,
oh, man.
But that was our first big account.
Yeah.
And it pushed us into the bigger league because that was an ongoing $500,000 account, so we could hire more people.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the California State Auto Association, which was a $3 million a year account.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, the big firms didn't believe we had. They said, a firm your size doesn't get that kind of program. So, well, it's nice if you don't think we can, but we did. And
mm-hmm.
we just built a staff that met their needs. And we didn't just do industrial psychology. There we used communications. We used MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the staff development you'd already put in place is very, very, very good thing, you know.
Yes, it was
yeah.
very helpful, and they liked our approach. It was holistic. It was not. It wasn't us coming in saying, "Well, we do surveys, so you need to survey."
Mm-hmm.
It was I listening to their issues, saying, "What you're trying to do is move from one business platform to another,"
mm-hmm.
and so we had to put together a change management approach for them
mm-hmm.
across their company,
mm-hmm.
and they were going from. And this was the early '90s,
mm-hmm.
and so this was they were ironically going to. Using credit cards and not insisting on cash payments. I don't know how they got away with that for so long, but as we talked about changing, their CEO said, I know how hard change is because I gave up my fountain pen last week for one of these ballpoint pens. And I just,
it's like 40 years late.
So yes, we've got our work cut out for us because he's not going to be helpful. But it was a real learning experience where we brought in some really good staff. And some of those people who worked for us, those are the ones that are now VPs of HR for major corporations. So I'm proud of what we did out there.
Yeah.
Do you feel like in your time at both OEC and then organizational strategies, do you feel like the industry caught up to you? Do you think that other people kind of caught up to this multidisciplinary approach?
Yes, they did. And I think, ironically, we were one of the first in the country, to my knowledge, that used organizational effectiveness. It used to be something else, organizational satisfaction, all these other terms. And I wanted to be effective, not satisfied. I didn't want satisfied employees. I wanted effective employees because I thought effective ones will be satisfied. So we work towards that. And I can see that. I can't see satisfaction. All of a sudden, it started popping up everywhere. And we had to really license the name. And it's like, wow, this is a little strange. And they copied us. And what happened is when we won the TV account, Coopers & Lybrand was a major firm at the time and was bidding against us. And they challenged us every which way they could. They said, it's not possible. They're too small. You can't hire them. And we got tested in front of their board of directors even, and we won that account because we had a broad approach to it. And all of a sudden, they all started using our terminology. So if I looked at my brochure and I looked at their website, I'm like, oh, they changed it to our wording. They're using our terminology. And so we got caught up with and surpassed. So eventually, it became harder to compete because these companies were picking up that you can't be just this narrow. But I think ironically, IIT and Dr. Raju stressed that because he came from IBM. He said, you have to be business-oriented. You have to look at the business problem you're trying to solve. You can't go in there and just have your one tool.
Wow. Eventually, you come here in 2012, or you return here in 2012. And how is that in terms of what changes had occurred in the school since you finished your PhD and... what were the improvements they'd made? What were the problems they were facing?
Well, I'd say I was pleasantly surprised. My journey had taken me where organizational strategies was big, but we had the downturn in 2008, and I had been becoming bored with doing it anyway because I was doing it for 25 years at that point. And I thought, I've got to find another career. I'm not good at doing something for too long. I want to have variety. And so I said, I want to look elsewhere. And I was on the board of the School of Psychology at the time. That was the Institute of Psychology, the College of Psychology. And I was the vice chair of that board. And so Dr. Mitchell, who was the then dean, I met with her just networking, saying I want to change career. And she said, oh, if I hear of anything, I'll let you know. And then 2 months later, I got a call from her and late at night, like at 9 o'clock at night, can I have a confidential discussion with you? What? She said, well, Bruce is leaving the center. I said, oh. She says, yeah, we need somebody to replace him. And, you know, I said, well, can I ask why he's leaving? Because I want, you know. She said, well, he's leaving voluntarily. He wants to leave because he wants to go make more money elsewhere. He's retiring in a few years. And so he's leaving. So I said, well, let me come up with some names for you. And she said, we were hoping you might consider it. And so we started having conversations. And I'd known about the center because when that was formed with Dr. Raju at the helm of it, he was the one who came up with the idea. He asked me and Dan Lazat and Bruce Fisher, who came here to run that, to help write the business plan. And so we actually crafted it together. So I knew the business plan. And I liked the idea. I liked everything about it. And ironically, I had told her, if I'm changing career, I'm going to go into higher ed or healthcare. Oh, okay. Those are my two main clients at this point, and I'm passionate about both. I believe in healthcare for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's not a right. It's a right in my view. It's not a privilege. And same with education. I think education, the more you can put it out there, the better off everybody's going to be. Mm-hmm. And so when she called and offered it, I said, well, let me think about that. Mm-hmm. And I called her back in a few days. I said, yeah, I think that's a great idea, but we'd have to make it work financially because I can't take a huge paycheck. Yeah. And so they worked it out. They gave me three jobs.
Okay. The new.
Yes.
Yes. There. Okay.
And so.
But originally it was the Center for Research and Services that still, or was it the one of the.
It was the leadership. Well, I got the Center for Research and Services. And then as Bruce was walking out, I said, oh, by the way, you've got the Leadership Academy also. Okay. And I said, well, come back in here. What is that? And he said, oh, it takes a day a month at most. Don't worry. They have one meeting a month. And the provost at the time was Alan Cram. Mm-hmm. And he had, when I interviewed with him, he said, by the way, don't underestimate the Leadership Academy. It's a gold mine. We don't want to lose that. That's critical for us. Mm-hmm. That's strategic. Mm-hmm. And as I went through the paces of getting started, I realized what a gem that was and what a joy it is to work with them. And so I grew that myself. I just said, we're going to grow this and grow the Center for Leadership Studies, which is also my resume now. Mm-hmm. And then they decided I should be a professor because I teach one course a year. Okay. They said, you advise so many students, because I hire about 60 students every year to work with the center. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of being around them, I'm advising them, mm-hmm. particularly the ones who work full-time on my staff. Mm-hmm. I took it on myself to care about their career, so I help guide them into career paths. And mm-hmm. when they're becoming fussy and, you know, argumentative with professors, I give them guidance, and they go, you don't want to do that. Here's how you want to mm-hmm. move to the next stage here. Yeah. But I'm very proud of what we've done with the center, mm-hmm. as my students now leave at better salaries than they were leaving it before.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that the kind of the familial warm atmosphere that kind of welcomed you here, has that been sustained, at least in the areas in which you're kind of dealing every day?
It's a good question. I think it has. I think particularly in IO psychology, again, that's where I live in there, in clinical psychology. And clinical psychology is still the same way as it was when I was here before. Okay. Those tend to be more sole providers. So they're all therapists, they have their own private practice, so their mindset is not teamwork. There's this, I'm going to sit with you. So they're a little harder to get into a team project. Okay. Although we have CPS, the Chicago Public Schools testing program, where that's where I employ most of my students in that program. The IO psychology program, they have to work in teams, because when you go out to industry, you're working on a team. If you're doing consulting, you're on a team. So we're teaching that, and I've built a team that's very collegial. And when I got here, Bruce Fisher built the thing, so he built a great center. I'm not faulting him, but his approach was, you will learn how to do surveys, you will learn how to do 360 surveys, you will learn this, and that's all you're going to do. So you're our expert, and what happens is, you're not in that day. Client calls up and says, I want to talk about my survey. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sorry, but he's not in today, and you can't talk to anybody till next week. I'm like, not working. Mm-hmm. And or if the person gets a job or leaves or graduates, you're trying to scramble. So I started cross training and saying, everybody has to know how to do everything, and you'll work in teams, because I want you all to know each other's projects, because you're supporting each other.
Mm-hmm. So you've returned to the multidisciplinary approach.
Yes, and I've also brought in other kinds of students, which is controversial with the faculty, as I'm bringing in a sociology student, because we just want to. I'm very proud of the fact that we got one of the first MacArthur grants here, and MacArthur is a huge grant-making organization, and we got a seminal grant to study minority contractors in the greater Chicago and Illinois area, and why they're not getting more big public programs for themselves. And the psychology department was shocked, saying, why would you go after that? And I said, well, that is a selection problem. That is a sociological problem. We're part of the School of Human Sciences. We can bring people from sociology. And I got this very cross look, like, You're psychology. Don't bring in other people. Mm-hmm. I said, no, it doesn't work that way. In my world, they're working with people across the industries. Mm-hmm. So if they can't do it today, they won't do it tomorrow. So,
Well, that fits the school's official posture over the last 20 years or more, which is interdisciplinary and project-driven and whatnot.
So, yeah, and I was thrilled when I came back and I found iPro was here. Mm-hmm. And iPro makes a huge difference here, which we had nothing like that back then. Mm-hmm. Okay. And psychology has gotten much stronger since I was here, to the point of I wonder if I would get in. But the professors are much more nationally recognized. Ron Landis is internationally recognized. Roy Imans internationally recognized. I mean, we're getting some very strong players in that department. And when I was here, we had two, Dr. Raju and Maury Aderman. And Maury was almost retired on the job, if you will. And Nam was fairly new at the time. But it worked out really well. I'm very proud of the program. And I don't think I could have come back if I was not proud of it. But when once I got here and took the job, I was like, I was shocked at how good it was.
Wow. That's great. Right. In one sense, 5 years isn't a huge amount of time, but what are some of the changes in the last 5 years that
over the 5 years?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Well, obviously, with the change in administration, there was some changing there. But and we changed our dean in the School of Psychology. It became the School of Human Sciences. And Dr. Mitchell stepped aside. She wasn't renewed, and a new dean came in. And people were very upset by that. And I'm still friends with Eleanor, but I wasn't that upset because, to me, she had been doing that 19 years. And I think I'm a believer in fresh blood. So that's why my contract here is for 3 more years, and I've said I'm ready to go. I'll cut back whatever you need or don't need. That's fine, because I get bored, and I think most people do. And so if you've got somebody in there for that long, it becomes routine, and there's nothing. So Dr. Himes, that came in after her, is a sociologist, which was I was on the selection committee, and I got some grief for like, why didn't you put a psychologist in there? Why didn't you back a psychologist? I said, because I think she was the best candidate. I'm sorry. They're not going to get something different. They knew what they were hiring, because when I came in, my philosophy was quite clear. I had to meet with the entire faculty before I got the job. And I gave them my philosophy and why I was coming. So they shouldn't be surprised.
Good. Well, it gave a bit more of a buck up for some of the non-psychology professions.
Right, and I think it's important to do that, because we have a number of other professions that are not scientific necessarily, but they contribute to the life of the campus. And so even the humanities I'd like to see more of, and the English department, and not the department, but it's all within humanities, but we've got some strong players in there, I think that's changed over the years. Within my department, what's changed is the students are I guess there's less turnover in the center, which I'm proud of, because there were some students who would never leave and they would never graduate. They stayed 10 years. And I thought, that's not right. And some students would come in and go right away, and there was constant churn. And I thought, well, that's not comfortable either, because the clients don't get what they need and students don't stay long enough to learn. So I started slowly setting a different pace in there. And professionalizing the firm. The center is called my firm. But when I got there, they were all in jeans and torn t-shirts. I had wanted the dress code to change, and they were tippy-toeing around me on that. And they finally got comfortable enough to say, we heard from Bruce that you were going to change the dress code. Is that true? And I said, point of fact, yes. It is true. I said, because I think the world of you guys, but you look like students. They said, well, we are. I said, not in this setting or not. I said, when you're here, you're a consultant. That's your title. And I said, and your clients are in the hallway, because the deans hire you. The president hires you. The provost hires you. If he sees you in a t-shirt and torn jeans, he looks at you one way. If you come in business casual, I don't need you in a suit and tie, but I need you at least business casual. Oh, that's expensive. And I said, you just went to India for a wedding. I think some of that money could have been used for that. I know you just bought this new car, and you're a grad student. So I said, I think you can find a bit of money. So why don't we say by next month it'll change? The next week, they were all dressed differently. And they didn't look back. But I basically said, you have to be proud of what you're doing. And then you have to know why you're learning it. And you have to know how to apply it. And then be proud enough to know what you're worth. So when they were graduating, they were going hat in hand almost humbly, you know, well, we're just from IIT. And I said, no, you're not just from IIT. You are from Illinois Tech. And you have been working here 5 years, 4 or 5 years. You should get paid more. You're not going as entry level. And that changed the dynamic because I also have a board that hires them. And even Bruce, ironically, was saying, well, I'm going to hire so-and-so, and I'm going to pay them $40,000 a year. I said, no, you're not. He said, George, I can hire them. I said, no, you're not. I said, they're worth more than that, and you know it. But he was still seeing them as students, and I was seeing them as young professionals. So the mind shift is significant there. In them, it became different. And so the one person he tried to hire for 40, she turned down. She went to work for the city for 65. Jeremy Watson, who left 3 years ago now, I said, Jeremy, you've been here 5 years. You've been working as a project manager. He was my right hand in the center when he left. He had worked with all the senior execs here. I said, you shouldn't take less than 6 figures. And he left. He went to work for J.D. Powers. He's one of the senior psychologists there doing interpretation of stats results. He oversees the evaluation of the airlines and car companies. He said, best thing you ever told me was that. I just said, I want this, and they gave me it. I was like, you have to know how to position yourself. And so Sean Williams, who left last year, he went to work for one of my board members, who said, I can get it. I said, John, you're being short-sighted. He won't go there. Sean in particular was a specialist in metrics, psychological metrics. It's a big and growing field. But Sean is a data geek, loves it. You know he's in demand. You won't find another one like him. Don't mess this up. Sean left for 6 figures. So I'm pushing them and I'm pushing the other side thing, play well together. And that's what moves me. The administrative stuff doesn't move me. Being a senior administrator doesn't bother me. It doesn't move my heart anymore. I've done that. I've been there. But seeing students grow and move is amazing to me.
You had a particular experience as a student.
Yes.
Also finding a way to kind of advocate for yourself and make some good money.
Right.
And so, I can imagine it would be tough after having that experience yourself to watch the people that you're trying to shepherd out into the world walk out into a $40,000 salary.
Yeah. Well, it was depressing to me. It was like, well, why aren't you more proud about what you're doing? And then, well, they were good students, so studying hard, but they thought, well, psychologists don't make that much money. I said, in point of fact, they do, but you have to ask for it, and you have to. Now, I won't speak for clinical psychology because that's controlled by insurance companies, what they can bill and all that. But industrial psychologists tend to be heads of companies, though. They tend to be heads of HR. They tend to be, and so they can make good money. And if they have a consulting firm, you make outstanding money. So,
Well, good. Get that false internalization out from people because of that.
Well, and the same thing with the Leadership Academy. The Leadership Academy, we one of my proud stories for Leadership Academy is they were getting. I career coached them as well. When I first got here, career coaching and career services was not strong. It's since changed over the last few years, so I'm very happy about that. But they were coming to find me, and one student in particular, Emmanuel Clue, who was in CS here, he had gotten into the academy, and he had gotten in my first year. And very quiet leader, but very thoughtful and precise, and when he does speak, people listen. Well, Goldman Sachs loved him. He was interning for them summer after summer. And ironically, the woman who hired him is a classmate of mine from IIT. She got her doctorate in psychology when I was here. And I used to hang around with Liz. And so she said, we love Emmanuel. We're going to get him full time. I said, I hope you're going to pay because he's in demand. And so they didn't get him. They bid the lowest. And Emmanuel left making six figures, and the first number was not a one. And he's now traveling the world running Zurich, and he's not very old. But the Leadership Academy is producing people who are really thoughtful, and they're they know the world, they want to understand the world better, they want to influence the world. And they're not all that ill, but they go off to the Peace Corps, they go off to do great things for the world, but some of them go off and the salaries tend to be higher than the average. The low salaries from the academy tend to be around 60 or 70 as undergrads. So in my day, we didn't even aspire to anything near that. When I was an undergrad, I thought, someday I'll make $20,000 a year. I'm lucky.
Back in those days, so.
Well, it's 100 years ago now. But
well, we're coming up on the, I want to be cognizant of your time. So we're coming up on the final stretch here. But I wanted to make sure there wasn't anything about your IIT experience or your professional life that we maybe didn't touch on or glossed over that you kind of wanted to return to or expound on?
I'm trying to think, we've gone through quite a bit. There was a big family, I just want to emphasize, there was a family feeling in being in industrial psychology here because we spent holidays together. And so it wasn't just me not going home, it was a bunch of students not going home. And we'd be at Namraju's house or we'd be getting together within our dorms or the apartments and cooking dinner and having fun. And so we went through as a cohort and it was a very strong group. And to this day, we still know each other. We know where each other are. So I can name you my classmates, where they're at. They're all in highly successful jobs. So that, it made a huge difference to be in this school. Because I've been told other schools are like, and they're serious academically, but they're not humanistic or they're not building community. And I think what's not, we don't emphasize here enough, I think, is the community atmosphere and building it further. Because I just helped this College of Science with their next strategic plan. And all I kept hearing was, but we are a community of researchers. I said, well, put that in your plan. Advertise that. Oh, no, we're serious scientists, though. Like, but people go where they think they'll be welcome. And so I feel like the big fuzzy guy around here going like, but you are friendly and you are, you know, a community. And they're like, yeah, but don't tell anybody that. Like, that's the wrong thing to do. And yeah, you can be serious about what you're doing, but you can do it in a way that you're including everybody. And in point of fact, they are doing it, but it's just not advertised.
It's just always important, and I think in these days especially.
Where that shows itself a lot also, our board is really dedicated to the school. I've worked with other boards for colleges, and they're much more standoffish or removed. Here, the board is really involved, and they really care about the students. And they have dinner with my academy once a year. One or two of them have dinner with them, and they adopt them and say, I'll guide you through your career. And so the one of the fellows who's in CS, Sherry Littlejohn, who was head of IT architecture for Wells Fargo, adopted him and said, I'll help you with your career if you want. And so they were on the phone all the time. Exchanging. Now he's at KQRI, he's very successful there. So this school has heart, and it doesn't show the heart enough. I think it's not out there, because I was shocked when I came here. I said, I've seen more good, don't take this wrong, more good Christian acts here than I have in my Catholic college. And I said, this, what do you mean by that? I said, they're just doing good because it's the right thing to do. They're not tying it to a religion, you know.
Which is the way it should be.
That's my philosophy, and I'm sticking to it. And ironically, I was studying to be a priest, but I'm no longer Catholic. I'm more of just general, spiritual.
Right, still doing the mission.
Yes, this feels good. It feels like coming home, because I had originally wanted to be a teacher early on in my life. And ironically, I resisted it with everything in me, because Namraju wanted me to be a professor. I said, I don't want to be a professor. I said, you don't make enough money, I'm sorry. And he said, oh, I said, well, you don't, really. And so, but a bunch of us who went off are back.
And we're doing
And they did bump it up for you. And
They did.
Education in a broader field as well, broader sense.
Right, and the school does make you feel at home, like you're part of the team. So sometimes it's a bumpy ride. There, people have strong opinions. There's no lack of opinions and voice of that, but it builds you stronger. That's
Great. Well, George, thanks so much for spending part of your afternoon with us.
Oh, good. I hope you got what you needed from this. And
Sure.
That speaks a lot to the school.
Oh, good.
Yourself
good.
As well.
Good.